This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or tieke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family, a family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the tieke from total extinction.
Tune in at 11 a.m. Tuesdays with Marvin Hubbard
on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM.
We can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos.
Hello, friends. You'll be listening to Dr. Mike Rayner talking about how we should label our food. This is a pre-record, but I think we've got a subject that's not only timely, but timeless, since I expect we'll be eating food, purchased food, for some time. Dr. Rayner, how do you wish to be addressed?
As Mike would be okay. Fine.
Well, Dr. Mike Rayner is the director of the British Heart Foundation and Health Promotion Research Group. And he's doing a lecture at Otago University on the subject of food labeling and food marketing, food taxes, and the relationship between a healthy diet and a sustainable diet. And he's also chair of Sustain and chair of the Food Children's Campaign in UK. How are you, Mike?
I'm good, thanks very much. Yep, enjoying the weather.
Are you a medical doctor or a science doctor?
No, I'm a science doctor, a PhD, not a MD.
Now, when we talk about, how did you get interested in food?
I'm interested in food because I sort of rather fell into it, I suppose. But I think food is a really essential thing for all of us. I mean, we need food to eat. But it's also a very political subject. It's a very religious subject as well. So it's interesting on all sorts of levels, I think, food.
It's interesting that food has become a tool of politics and power. Has it always been the case?
I think so, yes. Ever since time began, I think food has been struggled over. You know, poor people are poor because they can't get enough food.
And if you control food, you control a certain amount of power, don't you?
Indeed, you do, yeah.
Isn't that what the big argument is? Is that the basis of our argument over labeling, our argument over organic, our argument over genetic engineering of food? It isn't necessarily about the science, is it? It's more about the power.
I think there is a scientific dimension to it, and I think science will provide some of the solutions to our problems around labeling. But yes, ultimately, it's up to the politicians and those of us who vote for them to decide how our food is going to be labeled.
Okay, what does food labeling mean? I mean, that's a fairly broad category.
Well, food labeling, for me, is what you find on a food packet, largely. But nowadays you can find information and claims about foods in all sorts of places, not just on food packets, but you can find it on shelves, on the internet, on mobile phones, in all sorts of ways you can find what I think is labeling of food.
Well, a lot of labeling of food is promotion of that. food.
Well, I think labelling divides into two types, really. It's on the one hand, it's useful information. We need to know how to cook our foods. We need to know what's in them. We need to know when we should eat them by, for example. So there's a bit of labelling is actually information. But a lot of labelling is just marketing claims, really serving not the interests of consumers, but the interests of the producers and the retailers.
With this labelling, I'm not sure that most people can, if they read the numbers and so on, that it isn't, most people don't necessarily understand what they mean.
No, the bits of the label that the producers want
to sell. I mean, maybe really important information, but how many people understand the information?
Well, the bits of the label that the producers want us to understand are quite clear. And when it says low fat, you know that it's low fat according to them. But when it says X grams per 100 grams or X grams per serving of fat, you don't. Yeah. So I mean, there's a lot of obfuscation in labeling.
You may not even recognize the product that they're, they say how many grams of a scientific word, unless you speak Latin.
No, for lots of labelling, or particularly the nutrition information, and some degree the ingredients lists, you need, you know, quite a lot of knowledge to understand it. Nutrition knowledge, or even mathematical knowledge to make sense of the numbers.
And you know, it may be a low fat but high sugar, for instance.
Well, yes. I mean, as I say, labelling divides into the bit which is useful to consumers, like the nutrition information, and the bit, or potentially useful to consumers, rather. And then there are loads of health claims, like, on the front, mainly, which markets the foods to us. But, I mean, there are attempts all around the world to make the nutrition information more understandable to consumers. Okay. So, for example, in Britain, we've got this thing called traffic light labelling, which is front-to-back information, which is actually useful to consumers because you can see at a glance the whether the food is healthy or not.
Could you tell us about that?
Well, basically, what we've done in the UK is try to make the labelling more understandable to consumers so they can make better choices about the health on the basis of the nutrient content of the foods. And so what's happened there is that you have a little panel on the front of the packets which labels the fat, the saturated fat, the sugar and the salt as either red, orange and green. And so if there are lots of red lights on the packet, you know it's an unhealthy food. And if there are lots of green lights on the packet, you know that it's a healthy food.
Now, that's something that the food manufacturers may not go for.
They may not go for it, but the British government has recommended this as their preferred way that manufacturers and retailers should label their foods. And the anticipation is around that 60% of foods in the UK will shortly be labelled in this way. It's a sort of voluntary initiative because in Britain, food labelling legislation is controlled by the EU. So the British government couldn't force manufacturers and retailers to label the foods in this way, but they said that this is the way they want people to do it, and I think about 60% will do it in the end.
I guess if 60% do it, there's some pressure for the others to go ahead.
Yeah,
if you see
a tipping point.
A large proportion of your labeling is easy to read, and you notice that some isn't, you might choose the one you can read.
Indeed. And you've got a similar sort of situation going on here where the Australian government and the New Zealand government are looking at a better form of front-to-back labelling called a star health rating system. And, I mean, if you could get that off the ground, I think that would be really good.
What's the difference?
Well, the traffic light labelling is slightly different. For me, it's better because it's easier to see that a food is unhealthy when it's got lots of red lights and healthy when it's got lots of green lights. For the starring system, you've got to get lots of stars, and there's a lot of stars. It sort of means it's healthy, I think. So I think it's very similar in many respects. One uses stars, one uses colours. So
it's just a bit easier to read.
I think the colours are better, but I'm British.
Yes. One of the questions you have is how you decide. Who decides who decides what should get red and what should get green?
Well, I really think that should be where the government should take a lead. So they should be setting the nutrient criteria for these schemes, and that's where they have a clear role to tell the manufacturers and the consumers and the retailers and everyone what is healthy and what is not. If you leave it up to the manufacturers, the ones that are making butter will think, or dairy products will think that dairy products are healthy. The ones that are making margarine and other sorts of spreads will think that their products are healthy. So you've got to have the government
fiddling with the market. Isn't that fiddling with the market, influencing the market?
Well, if they decide, yes. If you leave it up to the manufacturers to decide, yes, that's not good.
But if the government decides, they're interfering with the market, aren't they?
They are interfering in the market, yeah. I mean, but that's what governments should
ever interfere with the market?
Of course, governments should interfere with markets. That's their job. They have to interfere in the markets to protect the consumers.
They've been telling us for the last 30 years they shouldn't.
Well, they do in all sorts of other areas, like, you know, alcohol and tobacco.
Well, that's interesting when you bring up tobacco, because the government of Australia, the last Labor government, was sued by multinational corporations because they wanted to label cigarettes as dangerous, and they also wanted to put them in plain packages.
Well, of course, multinationals
are going to sue. It's interesting that they can sue a government for trying to provide health information on products.
Well, they can try because of international trade agreements, and we need to look very carefully what's happening in relation to international trade agreements to make sure that governments can still label tobacco and, in future, food, as in the way that is helpful to consumers.
Well, countries in the Pacific may soon be signing a trade pact called the Pan-Pacific Trade Agreement, PPPTA, and which will prevent them from interfering with the market in this way, and may interfere with pharmac, the ability to subsidize medicine.
Well, Monsanto is not quite as close to signing as all that, but yes, I think in these agreements, consumers and people like us who are concerned with health should be taking a bigger a role. And I think really the public health community has neglected to look at trade agreements. I mean, in Europe we have a trade agreement that's called the EU, and actually to some degree that's been quite good for health in some respects, but in other areas it hasn't. And I think these trade agreements can be good for health. Actually, you just need to make sure that they are.
Governments and populations can influence the EU, can't they?
Yeah.
In theory, anyway.
We have such things as members of Parliament for the European Union, MEPs.
See, that's a big difference. I mean, I'm not saying the EU is above criticism, but you can influence it politically.
Yes.
Whereas some of these trade agreements, only corporations seem to be able to, and the courts they set up seem to be able to influence them.
Yes, and that's a really good point. Yes, I think these trade agreements need to be more open and transparent. There should be greater consultation going on around them. Yeah, and yes, the EU is a sort of trade agreement, but it also brings into those trade negotiations other considerations, such as, to some degree at least, health and consumer interests.
How much has health, our attitude toward food and health, changed in the last 20 years?
I think in many developed and developing countries, health is improving still. Life expectancy is increasing. I mean, the possible exception is Africa. And one of the reasons for that is that people are eating healthier diets. Over the last 20 years, we've reduced malnutrition, not getting enough protein and minerals and vitamins and so forth, to a considerable extent around the world. And that's been a great achievement in developed countries, Northern Europe and America, Australia, New Zealand, etc. Things have actually generally improved. We are eating slightly healthier diets. The fear is, I think, really for the future. One of the signs of that, of what might happen in the future, is, for example, the rise in obesity. I think the rise in obesity is a clear counter trend, really. It seems to suggest that and does suggest that diets are getting worse, that we're eating more and more unhealthy foods. And I think we need to watch that. I think this increase in life expectancy has really been based on using up the fossil fuels for myself, so that we're living healthier lives in most of the world because we're using up the world's resources. And that can't really go on for that long. And of course, it doesn't take account of the pollution that we're generating, particularly in relationship to global warming.
So it's a mixed picture, isn't it?
It's a mixed picture, yeah. But there are some signs that of hope. And actually, if you look at diets over the last 20, 30 years, one thing for sure that you can say is they changed a lot. So we can change our diets. I mean, it's not absolutely impossible to eat more healthily than we're eating.
Well, I know something in large cities in the United States, that sometimes flats and even family houses don't have much in the way of kitchens because everybody goes out for fast food.
No, I mean, that's another trend, actually, that within developed countries is rising inequalities, both in income and that means in terms of health as well. And one of the reasons for those rising inequalities in health are due to the rising inequalities in diets. So the poor are eating worse and the rich are eating better.
So there's that mix of politics, economics, and health again.
Of course.
It's
yes.
Always been that way, hasn't it?
Yep,
I think so. There were people writing about stockyards and health and safety of food production toward the end of the 19th century.
Yep.
Upton Sinclair, I think, wrote a famous book about it.
I read the first few pages, yes.
So
it's too grisly to read to the end, I felt.
But I must confess, I haven't read the whole book either. But I know it had an impact at the time.
It did, indeed, yeah.
So, it's about education and about research, but also getting that across, isn't it?
I think education always has a role to play. Education is important. We need to know stuff, and in getting people to change their diets, to helping people to eat more healthy, perhaps the first step at least is to give them the facts about what is a healthy diet and what isn't. I mean, we do have some pretty clear facts, like we know that a diet based on fruit and vegetable or consisting of more fruit and vegetables is better than a diet based on meat and animal-based products. So there are some basic facts that we need to get across. But actually, a lot of people know, for example, most people know that fruit and vegetables are good for them. The hard task, really, is to change the environment in which people are operating to make the healthy choices, the easier choices. And so fruit and vegetables are more expensive than unhealthy foods. And what we need to do is not just educate people, because I think we've done a lot of that over the years and it doesn't seem to have a lot of effect, though.
What if you can't afford fruit and vegetables and you can't afford fish and chips?
Well, governments need to step in on these sorts of levels. They need to interfere in the market, as you said earlier, to make sure that the prices of healthy foods are cheaper, affordable to poor people, and the prices of unhealthy foods are expensive. So that's why I'm in favour of a taxation system which taxes the unhealthy foods but subsidises, in my ideal world, the healthy foods. And it's not just about taxes, it's about the way foods are marketed in general, the way they're advertised by the companies, by the way they're positioned within shelves, the way they're made available to people. So all sorts of aspects of the marketing environment are important when it comes to food.
Do you think that we've overdone consumerism to such a stage that it actually affects our health and affects our food?
Yeah, I do think that. I think Western society over the last 20, 30 years has become more and more consumerist in most countries. Most Western countries. I think we need to think much more about communities and groups and the health of community and groups rather than just the health and well-being of individuals. I think we need to break away from that individualist, consumerist way of thinking.
I'm going to play a piece of music and then we'll continue.
trouble in the hand. We left our silent lives behind in a house of cards on shifting sand, at the edge of the sea in the land of the blind. We had it all and we let it go, just a bunch of fools without a clue, hypnotized by the TV show, hoping it'd tell us what to do in the land of the blind, in the land of the blind, in the land of the blind. The one-eyed man is king. It out. That easy life, it was fine with me. Now I know what it was all about, and it's a hell of a road to eternity in the land of the blind, in the land of the blind, in the land of the blind. The one-eyed man is king. Plays his fiddle and everybody sings along, but there's no one left to solve the riddle. They're dancing to a one-eyed song. Hey!
Hello, we're talking with Dr. Mike Rayner on food labeling and food health. He does research in this field in Great Britain, and we've been fortunate to have him come to New Zealand to help it bring these issues up. Mike, some people would say that if you're a family, you say you've got three children, you live in a flat, you're both working reasonably long hours, low wages, high rent. It's hard to switch into healthy food or healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, I think that's right. Healthier foods are more expensive than unhealthy foods.
And you need to prepare them?
And you also need to prepare them in general, yes. So you've got to cook them and take time to make them delicious if they're healthy.
And hopefully you need to come from a family that's taught you how to cook.
Yep, that's right. You need to I've been taught to cook at school. You need parents that have encouraged you to cook. All those sorts of things too.
Now, we're talking about food. We're also talking about agriculture. And we've been able to increase the amount of food, partly because using oil, at least. I'm aware that, for instance, in Asia, we got as much per acre out of the food 100 years ago as we do now. A lot more labor intensive, but they probably got as much rice or as much vegetables per acre as we now get on a modern farm. Are we going to eventually have to switch from industrial agriculture to something more organic?
Well, I think we need to rethink agricultural systems, because the agricultural side of food is clearly really important. Agriculture is largely subsidized in most developed countries. We need to think away the ways in which we subsidize our agricultural systems and how we reward our farmers for doing what they're doing. And they're obviously essential. We need farmers to grow our food. But yeah, I think we also need to think about the how sustainable those mm-hmm. food production systems are. I think we need to lose our dependence on fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are really important in farming because they create artificial fertilizers in particular, which is the basis of lots of modern industrial farming. And so what we need to do is change the way we farm, and indeed I think that will happen anyway, because as well it becomes more expensive, people will continue to think about more sustainable ways of producing food.
They're having this debate in places like India actually right now.
Yes, I don't think organic for me isn't the solution necessarily. I'm not. I think we do need science to help help us develop more sustainable farming. I think there's some interesting developments around genetic modified organisms, for example. I don't want to dump science.
Sure, but organic doesn't necessarily mean dumping science.
It has had a tendency, well, and not maybe not here, but has a tendency in Britain to be anti-scientific, to say things like GMOs are not important, or new genetic techniques are not important in farming. But I do think we need technology as well to produce our solutions.
I guess one of the questions, of course, one of the reasons why genetic engineering has such a bad image, I think there are two. One thing, it's a scary subject, it's genes, and we don't know much about them, most of the common.
Yeah.
The other thing is that they've been misused by Monsanto and others to patent food as a way of centralizing power and wealth over food.
Yes,
indeed. And I think that's probably one of the things that's caused people to oppose.
I think we have to be useful, careful about technology. I mean, my favorite piece of technology is the bicycle, because I don't have a car and I cycle to work and so forth. But the bicycle was used in the First World War to transport as a weapon of war, really. It was used to manipulate troops around. So, you know, all technology can be used for good and evil.
Sure. I wouldn't disagree with that. But I'm saying that we probably need to have some public control over the usage of genetic technology.
Yeah, I think the fundamental problem really is not so much technology here, it's the way companies are organized. For example, I think the shareholder as being in control of the company is a real problem. I think if we change the way companies were organized to make them a cooperative, for example, then companies would act in much more in the interests of the people they're serving, not their shareholders. It wouldn't all be for profit. It would be for the benefit of communities.
The problem is that under the present system, you're bound to increase the profits of the shareholders.
Exactly.
And also, it's probably gotten worse in the last 30 years because CEOs get rewarded for any raise in profits, even if it's very temporary, which it can be. And they get huge amounts of money, you know, millions of dollars sometimes, for short term. They even get millions of dollars when they say goodbye. You've done your job or you've made mistakes, so we don't need you anymore, but we give you this $1 million golden handshake.
Yes.
And that can't make for good policy, I wouldn't think.
Well, I still think we should. It's not just the wages of people in the companies that are important, and I agree we need to do something about that. But I think it's also the way companies are structured, and we need to think about new ways of developing commercial organizations.
We've had the possibility of organizing cooperatives for a long time.
Yeah, and they haven't taken off very well. But I think that's partly because governments haven't encouraged them, and I think governments need to encourage, do a lot more to encourage cooperatives.
And some countries have discouraged them.
Exactly.
So you think that food and why is there difficulty with food labeling in UE? I wouldn't have thought that would be the case.
Why is there...
Is there difficulty with food labeling in European Union?
In the European Union? Well, because there are a lot of countries involved in the discussions, but also the food companies that we've just been talking about have a lot of political influence when it comes to the way foods are labeled. So it seems to me, for example, that traffic light labeling is self-evidently a good thing, but the food companies have confused the debate. They said, we haven't got enough evidence that it works, it's too expensive to put on food packets, it demonizes foods when, you know, there's no such thing as healthy and unhealthy food. All these sorts of ridiculous arguments that the companies use to make it difficult for the politicians to act in the best interests of their citizens. So I think that's been the major problem in Europe, in getting better food labelling legislation and better food labelling in general, is that the food companies have obscured and obfuscated the debate.
Have we changed how... We changed the scientific evidence changed for what foods are different? Have we come up with evidence that things that we didn't think were unhealthy might be more unhealthy than we thought?
The basic ideas about what is healthy and unhealthy have been really known, I think, for centuries, really. I think everybody really knows what is healthy and unhealthy. I mean, nutritionists are really squabbling about the margins. For example, they're arguing at the moment about whether sugar is worse than fat. And actually, everybody knows really, or I think everybody knows really, that fat and sugar are equally unhealthy. I mean, it's a ridiculous debate. If we eat more sugar, if we encourage people to cut down on sugar, they're going to eat more fat and they'll get unhealthy. If we encourage people to eat less fat, they're going to eat more sugar and they're going to get unhealthy.
But what we have seen is we've seen a lot more sugar in shops, in the supermarkets.
I think added sugar...
You look at drinks, drinks, usually a lot of drinks. They're just... I think that the amount of sugar in the drinks as much as must have increased in the last 30 years.
I think Coca-Cola... it's about 9 teaspoonfuls of sugar in a can. It's a very delicious but unhealthy food. In my day, when I was a child, we were only allowed to drink it on birthdays and at Christmas because it was actually relatively more expensive than water and milk and even squash, which wasn't so high in sugar. So we were limited in our consumption. We were only allowed to eat it as a treat. And that's the way it should be. I think Coke is a delicious product, and I like to drink it, but I think I should only drink it rarely, possibly not even on a weekly basis, but on a monthly basis, say. And that's the way it should be. So that's what's happened. Coca-Cola has become switched from being a treat for birthdays and Christmas to being a regular food. And it's not a regular food at all. It's very much like alcohol. It's a treat food, which we don't need, but is enjoyable. And that's the problem with a lot of foods, like chocolate. Used to be a treat, and now people eat it every day. And that's the problem. It's not these foods are intrinsically unhealthy or intrinsically bad for us, although not that good for us, but they should be eaten as treats, and that's where the way they should be treated.
But it's actually cheaper to buy a lot of Coca-Cola-like products.
Yeah, because processed foods are cheaper to make. You just take the sugar and the fat and put it together in different combinations. It has a long shelf life, and therefore you don't need fridges to store it and stuff like that. It's easy to transport. All these unprocessed foods generally tend to be much less healthy than the ingredients from which they're made, and also the naturally occurring the unprocessed foods.
So the other thing that people see is you go into a store and you don't necessarily see the more ordinary foods first.
No.
Why is this?
Sometimes, of course, the retailers position their foods that they're making most profits on in the easiest accessible places in the store, in the middle shelves rather than at the entrances. And so there's obviously positioning within store is really important. But then also, of course, if you're a long way out of town, it's much easier and cheaper to transport unhealthy foods to your shops than the fruit and vegetables. Fruit and vegetables go off, and they, whereas the cocoa pops don't, for example.
Do you think the government has a... I guess you've already said the government has a role to play, but I know, for instance, in schools 6 years ago, you weren't allowed to sell junk food, high sugar products, mm-hmm. and so on. As soon as the conservative government came in, they said that's freedom of choice, mm-hmm. and therefore you can sell any kind of junk food. Well, not alcohol, but in school canteens on the school ground.
Yeah, that was clearly a bad step forward, or a bad step backwards, really. I mean, I think that was disgraceful on the part of the government. I mean, our government has done something similar, not quite as bad as that. What they've done in our country is we had really good standards before the coalition government got into power. And when the coalition got into power, they changed the way schools were organized, and they said that most schools didn't have to follow the guidelines anymore if they were going to become academies or free schools. So they changed the goalposts too, but they haven't actually abolished the standards. Keeping the standards is really essential for schools. Schools need standards to follow to make sure that they're supplying, when they do supply foods to their kids, that those foods are healthy.
Okay, we'll play one more song and then we'll talk some more.
One, two, three. There comes a time we realize some things we thought were true are lies. There comes a time when we must choose to recognize this or refuse. Uh-huh. Oh, you have it, live a lie. Mm-hmm. Oh, you have it, live a lie. Some ancestors showed no mercy. They raped and pillaged for their gain. They did all right by themselves while leaving people, families, countries in pain. Uh-huh. They were happy to live a lie. Mm-hmm. They were happy to live a lie. We live on the wealth they stole, and our systems ensure we keep control. Do you feel as I do, filthy in this muck? Then again, you may not give a flying. Are you happy to live a lie? Mm-hmm. Are you happy to live a lie? Myself, I'm gonna stay right here in this filth. You may think that kind of strange, but I'm gonna stamp my feet, vote and scream out loud. Maybe I can instigate some change, 'cause I'm no longer happy to live a lie. I'm no longer happy to live a lie.
We're talking with Dr. Mike Rainier on labeling of foods and the health of foods we eat. Has improved labeling of food improved the choices people make health-wise as far as food?
I think it's quite difficult to say whether it has or it has not. There have been improvements in food labelling in some parts of the world. We do have better information on our packets about the ingredients, for example, than we used to have, and we do have better information about the nutrients.
Where has this happened most spectacularly?
Well, it's happened around the world in relationship to ingredients, because the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization have a joint committee called the Codex Alimentarius Commission, which sets standards on food labeling. So, for example, that specifies that you must provide the ingredients with the biggest ingredient first, and so forth. So there are some standards for internationally agreed standards for foods. It's not actually just in developed countries where improvements are being made. Well, some South American countries have really got really worried about what's going on to their food supply, particularly the sort of increased amount of processed food. And places like Ecuador, for example, have introduced really interesting interesting front-of-pack labelling based on the UK traffic light system. And places like Chile and so forth have thought quite clearly about having health warnings on food, so not just highlighting or allowing manufacturers to highlight the healthier foods, but actually ensuring that if a food, for example, is high in salt, that it clearly says that on the packet. So it's pretty sporadic, but you know, there are some improvements. Whether it's made a difference or not, well, as I was saying earlier, I think diets have improved to some degree, and that's been partly driven, not, of course, just by food labelling, but by improved composition of foods and so forth. I think food is very difficult, if you look at the research, to find really clear effects of food labelling. I think food labelling has probably small effects, but because it's on every packet and affects every person, then those effects are important. And actually, I think that food labelling is a right. It's not so much whether it has an effect or not. I think consumers have the right to know in the most understandable way it can be given. You know, they need to know what's in their food in the most understandable way it can be given.
All right. The food labeling you mentioned international law and so on. So the international bodies have a big role to play in food labeling and food health.
Well, I think they should, and they're not as taken as much notice of as they should be. Basically, most developed countries invent their own standards based on the international standards, these international standards do have an important role to play in developing countries where they should sign up to these standards and they should put them into their law.
All right. How can we make that happen?
How can we make that happen? Well, international bodies like the World Health Organization are really very poorly resourced. I mean, I think it does a fantastic job in trying to improve health around the world. It used to be mostly concerned with things like infectious diseases like malaria and polio and stuff like that. But it's now, after a big high-level UN meeting in September of the year before last, got a grip on the fact that actually the burden of disease is changing around the world. It's becoming much more heart disease and cancer and chronic diseases like that are becoming much more important, even in Africa, even in developing countries. So it's really got a grip on the fact that it needs to do something about increasing burden of chronic disease relative to infectious disease. But it needs to better resourced. Governments need to give it more power, basically, to do stuff around things like food labelling, to set standards for food labelling, which are useful to consumers and health, and just don't serve the interests of manufacturers and retailers.
Do we also need to encourage things like exercise?
Physical activity is important. I mean, we've obviously just been talking about food today, but there's a whole host of other factors which affect our health. The big four for me are food, physical inactivity, alcohol consumption, and smoking. And of course, we can't just tackle food in isolation. We've also got to tackle physical inactivity and alcohol and smoking.
So we've made some progress, but how similar are the reactions of the really large agricultural firms to food labeling to the tobacco company's reaction?
I think there's a lot of parallels between big food and big tobacco. Both big food and big tobacco seek to make as much profit as they can out of their products, and in the case of big food, it's much easier and to make profits out of processed unhealthy food than it is out of unprocessed healthy food. So they're bound to try and stop any restrictions on things like taxes for tobacco or taxes for food, on restrictions on the advertising of tobacco or the restrictions on the advertising of unhealthy foods. The tactics they're using, big food, are learning from the tobacco companies. Indeed, a lot of the people who used to work for the tobacco companies are now working for big food. It's
yeah, they either were big food or big energy.
Big energy. Well, big energy is a really important issue coming up, I think, on the horizon, because it will affect things like our use of cars and other energy consuming devices. So yes, and as I said earlier, I mean, obviously, big food is dependent on big energy, and there's an alliance between the two. So I think yes, energy for me is really the key to the future and what we really should be concerned about.
Okay, what would you like to see done about that if you had...
Okay, well, for me, the really big problem in this world is global warming. We need to tackle that almost before we tackle anything else. And global warming is connected with this energy issue that I was talking about, and in order to tackle global warming, we need to do a host of things. And one of the things we need to do is change the way we eat. We need to eat much less meat and dairy products and much more plant-based products. So for me, that's the really big issue on the horizon, that people really need to cut down on meat in particular, particularly on sort of ruminant animals like cows in particular, but also sheep to some degree. I mean, of course, there are places in the world where you can only have sheep or only have cows, and we should continue to eat meat from cows and sheep. But in most of the world, we need to
balance,
cut down on
it. It's a question of balance.
It's not just a question of balance. I think balance is too easy a word, and I'm not sure whether it means anything much. It's really cutting down, which we need to do.
Well, if I eat seven meals a week and I have meat in one of them, that's a balance.
That's fine. It's not a balance to me. A balance would be 3 days of, or 3.5 days of meat and 3.5 days without meat. And I think we need to eat much less than 3.5 days of meat.
Okay. So how do you get to that stage? We're talking about food. We're talking about climate change. And we're talking about profit. And it seems to me that if profit's your main goal, how can you change the direction?
Well, I think we need to do lots of different things. We do need education, and we can't do without education. We need governments to step in a way which is much more interventionist in markets. They must think about the way foods are priced and intervene in the way that foods are priced, making, for example, meat more expensive. But then industry companies as well have a role to play. I mean, I think they're structured in such a way that they're bound to make profits for their shareholders. But they are human beings, these people in companies. They need to also change their ways and think about possibly restructuring their companies in ways which are better for consumers.
Or should we really consider that we could have different structures that were more amenable to the public and more amenable to the common good?
Yeah, I think we need to think philosophically and deeply about some of these big issues around energy and around the way commercial organizations are structured. I mean, obviously those things are big issue. Those issues are big and they're going to be hard to tackle. And so that's why I focus to some degree on small issues like food labeling, which I think I can do something about.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not sure I can do something about the way that, you know, the market economies are run in countries around the world. But we do need to do both. We can't, and also they're deeply connected. The way food labeling works is regulated is deeply embedded in the way things are, and we need to change the way things are as well as things like food labeling.
So it's a mixture, isn't it? You're on the you're hopeful that when you pay attention to education and food labeling, that maybe it'll make people think. How do we get people to think beyond the immediate?
I think we have much more power than we think we have. I think people feel disempowered from political processes, but I think actually if they thought about it, they could make a much bigger difference to the world than they imagine. And the way they do that, I think, is banding together with other people through political organizations, through campaigning organizations, single issue or otherwise. I think people just need to do stuff, really. They need to do politics with a small p. They don't just need to vote general elections or elections. They need to, in the meantime, do simple things like write to them representatives in Parliament and so forth. They need to combine with other people in writing the same letter to their members of Parliament. It's not rocket science, but I think people firstly need to realize that they have more political power than they actually do.
You think they need to regain their confidence so they can influence democracy?
Yeah, and I think the kids need to do this. In particular, I think the kids of today have been taught that, you know, they have no real way over the say over the way things are, and actually I think they need to be educated in schools to think more politically.
That's one of the things that I've got somewhat hopeful about, of course, in New Zealand is Generation Zero.
Right.
Because there are young people's organizations concerned about climate change.
Yeah.
And they're organizing themselves. And nobody organized them. They organize themselves.
Yes. Yes. Yes, if we're not going to educate them into doing it, maybe some of them will think, maybe they should do it themselves.
And do you think confidence builds on itself? Just as lack of confidence builds on failure or...
I think, yes, political... In campaigning, you need to have successes to carry on. I've been campaigning on food now for about 30 years. And if you look back, you can see things have improved in some small respects. And where you've had a say and... a bit of an influence over the way things have changed. So you do need successes. I think successes are going to be small, and you have to probably live a long time before you can see them.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show, and it's been really interesting talking with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.